When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Senior Producer Connor Boyle. Today, we're revisiting a discussion with one of the world's foremost cognitive psychologists, Steven Pinker. Pinker's work often focuses on language and human nature and how they contribute to society as a whole. Joining Pinker in conversation is David Runciman, the academic and podcaster who teaches politics and history at Cambridge University. The two discuss the advances made in our societies over the last several hundred years and whether optimism makes sense in today's turbulent times. We're listening to part one of the conversation today, and join us for part two in the following episode. And to hear the episode ad-free and support our mission to foster honest debate and compelling conversations, head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership or subscribe to our channel on Apple. Let's join David Runciman in conversation with Steven Pinker.
Hello, I'm David Runciman. Maybe to start with something that cuts across a lot of debates at the moment, and it's something that I'm increasingly struck by. There seems to be a new division. People are asked to pick sides. In a world where we're always being asked to pick sides, between optimism and pessimism. You're either going to be one of the optimists, or if you're not, you're one of the pessimists. So you use the language of optimism and pessimism in the book.
Occasionally.
Occasionally. But you also have a bit where you are wary of it. Why has that become the choice? How did we get to the point where, and you know, I'm asked this question a lot. You talk about something in contemporary politics or contemporary social developments, and people want to know, so does that make you one of the optimists or one of the pessimists? How did we get here?
Well, it's not clear that that this represents a change from the past, because there have been famously optimistic and pessimistic politicians in the past. Franklin Delano Roosevelt famously said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." Ronald Reagan said, "It's morning in America." So the language has been with us probably for as long as there's been politics. I think that the new focus on what is, I think, mistakenly called optimism comes from the fact that for the first time there's been attention to data on whether there has been progress in the past. Now, that's a different question as to whether things will get better in the future, but it's surely relevant to it. And many people have opinions on which way they think the world is going, which way they think society is going, which are claims about particular measures of human well-being, war, crime, prosperity, health, and which are testable claims. But until recently, no one has really tried to plot out the trajectory of the world in the past empirically, so that our opinions on the present are actually informed by our best knowledge of which way the world is going. And we just know from opinion surveys that people have systematically incorrect assumptions about recent change. They think that global poverty is increasing. It's been, in fact, decreasing by a lot. They think that deaths in war have been increasing. They've been decreasing. They think that crime is increasing. They're wrong. And the kind of argument that I have made is not one of prognostication into the future, but it's just pointing out facts that people don't know. And that is often mistaken for optimism, a doctrine that I don't think is particularly coherent. There's no reason to think that things will automatically get better any more than they'll automatically get worse. But because of that category, that dichotomy in people's minds, they think that pointing out facts that things have gotten better is a form of optimism.
Because you could say that the thing we want to avoid here is fatalism. And both
Indeed.
Optimism and pessimism can be, and in some ways inherently are, forms of fatalism. They plot trajectories from the past to the future. And I think you used the Hans Rosling phrase, possibilism, or to be a possibilist.
Yes.
The future needs to be open, however you use the data from the past.
Indeed. And of course, the future is open. It's going to depend.
It's more open than the past.
It's quite right. I'm repeatedly bemused, annoyed, frustrated by the fact that people mistake, to borrow another Rosling term, factfulness, namely the idea that our opinions ought to be informed by our best data. And the facts show that there has been improvement. That's not optimism. That's looking at reality as opposed to speculating based on your imagination and your preconceptions.
So one of the things that has puzzled me here, and again, it comes out of a range of writing, yours, but also the Factfulness book, is that as you describe and make a very persuasive case, we're kind of hardwired to favor bad news over good news. There are various aspects to how we function cognitively. It's not just, you can't just blame it on the media. You can't blame it on a new news environment, as it were. That's responding to certain cues that we are primed to pick up on. So Rosling shows that you ask people basic questions about the world and they think it's much worse than it is. And this includes people working in government, in the aid industry, people who are working in NGOs, people who are working in universities, intelligent, well-informed people get the world wrong. People have presumably always got the world wrong. And yet those are the people who have produced this trajectory towards progress. As it were, a world of pessimists, if we can call them that, or people who misapprehend the world. These are also the people out of whom progress has come. We've never had a society or a community where people have been genuinely fully aware of the progress that's been made.
I think you are wrong. Yeah, at least I'd want to see evidence that that's the case.
And evidence that we've never had societies where people have been genuinely attuned to the way the world is going?
Well, okay, so let me take a step back.
Yeah.
It is certainly true that a pervasive feature of our psychology is that we are more affected by the negative than the positive. Called the negativity bias, bad is stronger than good. We dread losses more than we enjoy gains. There are many more words for negative emotions than for positive emotions. We remember bad events more than good events. But of course, it can't be that locks us into a constant level of pessimism. Otherwise, we would all be equally pessimistic at all points in history, and that's clearly not true. Now, I don't know if pessimism means recognizing problems. I think that's not a very useful characterization of pessimism, because clearly problems don't solve themselves. That's like the fundamental law of the universe. There are many more ways for things to go wrong than for things to go right. That's presumably why the negativity bias evolved in the first place. And I would say that improvements in the past weren't made by, again, I don't know what you mean by pessimists. They're certainly.
Yeah, I'm using the language that I said we shouldn't use, so we need a different term for it.
Yes. So if.
People who do not have the facts present in mind, people have misunderstood the world that they live in, and yet those people also are producing progress.
I'd like to see evidence for that. I don't think that is correct.
So the audiences that Rosling talks to, all of whom consistently get the world wrong, these are also the people who are working in this world to make it better.
Well, no, because almost everyone that Rosling talks to gets it wrong. Mm-hmm. Many of the people who actually are working to make it better are not misinformed in the way that the majority of his audience is. In fact, many of the people who are doing the most, well, just Bill Gates would be an example. And he is someone who is well aware of the data that progress is possible, which is precisely what emboldens him to push forward with his philanthropic endeavors. So Norman Borlaug, father of the Green Revolution, credited with saving a billion lives by the development of vigorous hybrids. Was he a pessimist? He recognized that there was massive hunger and famine and insufficient calories. That's not pessimism. That's an acknowledgement of reality. At the same time, he reasonably thought that there are routes to improving plant varieties that could alleviate this calorie insufficiency, and so he worked very hard to develop them. Now, is that pessimism? The fact that he noticed people are dying of starvation, that's not pessimism. That's an awareness of reality. So yes, it is only the recognition of problems that allows problems to be solved, because problems don't solve themselves. That's not pessimism by any reasonable definition of pessimism. Surely it's that pessimism doesn't consist of opening your eyes, seeing the problems around you and wanting to solve them.
And so let's park the pessimism, optimism. It's my fault. I brought it back in language. A society of people, a developed Western society like ours, which is at the moment seems to be full of people misapprehending the world, inherently fearing the worst when there are many things that are getting better all around them. A society which is fully cognizant of the facts. So we don't, these people you talk about, they are the few, the minority. They are often pioneers or visionaries.
Yeah.
What would a society where, as it were, everyone got it be like? I mean, this is an open question because we've never had one.
Yes.
I mean, do you have a sense it would be an extraordinarily like turbocharged progressive society? Would it be different from ours? What would it be like where the news was a fair reflection of the world? Because it's quite hard to imagine it.
Yes. I think it could be more constructive. Again, I'm always wary of imagining some impossible utopian future in which human nature has been zeroed out. But I do think that the needle can be moved. And I think that for example, in the case of, let's take probably our biggest challenge right now, which is the climate. I often hear people say and write, we're cooked. Nothing we can do about it. Let's enjoy life while we can.
And that's the fatalism. Right?
That is the fatalism. I believe that if there was more discussion in academia, in the media, of pathways to a decarbonized economy, how do we get there from here? What would realistically allow us to enjoy all the advantages of energy without damaging greenhouse gas emissions? That we would move more quickly. We would have less climate denial. We'd have a better chance of surviving this crisis. In fact, this is not just my own speculation, but there are studies that show that if you present to people the idea that, for example, nuclear power might be a way of dealing with climate change, now, without advocating that it is, but just noting that it could be, fewer people deny the fact that human activity is warming the climate in the first place. Now, of course, that's irrational. Whether or not there exists a solution to a problem is independent of whether the problem exists. But it is part of our psychology that we're more likely to accept the existence of a problem if we think that there's a way out of it. And that's a feature of psychology that perhaps could be constructively exploited if we had a more reality-based discussion, both an assessment of our current situation, the possible routes forward, a look back to see if the routes that we're anticipating are realistic, namely, has the world in the past done anything like what we're advocating it do at the present, just to calibrate our hopes and expectations to reality. But yeah, I think that would be a better society. I don't imagine that we'll ever get to a point where everyone thinks like that. But on the other hand, everyone doesn't have to think like that because, as we know, there's no complete participatory democracy where every decision gets made based on public opinion. Elites get their way for better or worse. And even if the people with their hands on the levers of power have a more reality-based view, that would be sufficient to put us in a better position.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
The climate question raises a category that you write about in Enlightenment Now. Again, a relatively new term, existential risk and existential threats. And climate is sometimes characterized as one of those. And there are big risks with thinking in terms of existential risk. And you highlight some of them. I mean, one is fatalism. We're screwed. Nothing we can do. Another is that we spend so much time thinking this is such a terrible prognosis. We need to do, you know, prioritize it, that we don't accept the risks that come with overemphasizing a worst case scenario, even if it's reasonably remote. But Martin Rees has made an argument in his most recent book, not the Our Final Century one, but The Human Future, where he says one of his problems is we now live in a world which faces these enormous potentially existential challenges. And unlike in the past, they are man-made, they are human-made. And we, you know, it depends on us. And in many cases, we know what to do. We just don't do it. And this is relatively recent evidence of human incapacity to deal with these things. It's not like these are acts of God and we do what we can and hope for the best. We could do something about this and we're not. And he says that gap, again, I'm not going to call it pessimism, but that gap is the thing that gives him pause and thinks that this might be different. We're now living in a world where the human-made threats are real, the human capacity to deal with them because we made them is real, and we're not.
Well, we may not, but we ought to. But the
fact that we're not is being driven by what? Is it by this innate? Because this is in a context of existential risk, where he's talking about thinking about these worst case scenarios.
Yes. Yeah, so I have a public bet with Sir Martin on whether an act of bioterror or bio error will kill 1 million people before the year 2020.
Which is next year. When did you take the bet?
Just 2 years ago. I think I'm going to win, but...
Oh, those are good odds.
Hope so.
You got.
I think so, yes. We don't know that we're incapable of acting on it. The world has gotten together and dealt with pretty serious threats in the past. The ban on atmospheric nuclear testing, the ban on chlorofluorocarbons. The Paris Accords were not sufficient to deal with climate change, and of course, the United States is planning to withdraw from them. But it does show that the world can get together and agree on a course of action. And if the accelerating targets are implemented, then that it's a possible route to dealing with it. And it could be that as weather events get more unignorable, that public opinion will increase even further toward accepting the reality of climate change. And a majority of people already do accept it. There are various forces in government that prevent everyone from acting on it. It's possible that even though we ought to act now aggressively based on the quite reasonable projections of climate scientists, that it will take more salient disasters that make headlines to move people's hearts and minds. People might move too late, not enough, but on the other hand, they might move enough in time if the headlines remind them of something that they ought to have recognized just from the analyses.
So in a way, is it that it's the gap between facts or factfulness and experience that's still the barrier here? We have to close that gap.
We certainly have to close that gap. We have to depoliticize many of the formidable issues that are facing us, climate change being a paradigm case where the denial of man-made climate change, it turns out, has nothing to do with scientific ignorance, which is what most scientists mistakenly believe. The polls are very clear that climate change acceptors are no more scientifically literate than the deniers on average. What differentiates them is politics. The farther you are to the right, the more you reject climate change. And I think that our thought leaders, our scientists, our politicians, our activists have been oblivious to the damage that has been done by politicizing climate change. There are some climate experts who say that the worst thing that's happened to the climate movement was Al Gore producing the movie An Inconvenient Truth, because that made it a left-wing issue. And then if it's a left-wing issue, the people on the right are not going to get aboard. So that's another problem. I think a third problem is a kind of traditional legacy green thinking about the environment that rejects technological change, that blurs the climate problem with a variety of other green issues such as smallness and return to the land and a rejection of capitalism and democracy, often merged with a laundry list of other left-wing issues. We see that in the United States now in the so-called Green New Deal, which is a kind of dog's breakfast of left-wing causes, which in fact don't add up to actually solving the climate change problem. Anyway, those are three impediments to dealing wisely with climate.
Can we talk about the Enlightenment? Because that's, after all, the theme of your book. And the Enlightenment itself is, it cannot be sort of placed somewhere on these binary divisions between optimism and pessimism. It's an incredibly complex historical phenomenon, both at the level of the individual thinkers. And we know the Enlightenment in your university, in my university, has an increasingly bad name mm-hmm. among a younger generation of students for whom you can't extract the good progressive ideas, given the context in which they came up and also some of the views that went along with them. Are you trying to extract the core from what you think are peripheral ideas? Can you do that? Is there a way of separating out in this complex phenomenon the bits that you want to emphasize from mainstream 18th and 19th century thought, much of which for many people now is abhorrent?
Yes, absolutely. That's the whole point of the book. The point of Enlightenment Now is not, let's look back to a bunch of great guys in the second half of the 18th century and do what they say.
That would be a bad idea.
That would be a bad idea. And that is adamantly not what the book says. The book's idea is captured in the subtitle, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Now, rather than listing those four abstract nouns, I wanted a label for that quartet. I could have called it Cosmopolitan Liberalism Now or Secular Humanism Now. But conventional ways of talking, these ideas are called Enlightenment values, Enlightenment ideals. And so that's the term that I used. And indeed, a lot of them were articulated during the Enlightenment to give those 18th century dudes their due. But it would be against the spirit of Enlightenment ideals to hold the people in that era up as a kind of secular prophets or people who are giving us wisdom, whose texts we should parse, whose creed we should sign on to. That's a common misunderstanding of the book, even though it is explicitly disavowed in the chapter on the Enlightenment.
So you could have called it Enlightenment 2.0 or something. I mean, Enlightenment Now sounds a bit like that thing now.
Well,
yours is the New Enlightenment, isn't it?
Aren't well, in fact, the New Enlightenment was the original title of the book. But
you never considered 2.0. That's too much of a cliche.
It's so 1990s.
I know. Yeah,
so. And in fact, there is a book called Enlightenment 2.0.
There's always
a book. No one's heard of it. So yes. There's a common misunderstanding, particularly among people who study the Enlightenment, who think, oh, he's talking about what I've spent my life studying. But in fact, those guys disagreed with each other. Well, yes, I know that. A lot of the questions—
They disagreed with themselves in some sense as well. I mean,
and with themselves.
Internally, this is not a coherent—
Absolutely. And the Enlightenment is not a creed. Some of the questions that they were obsessed with are almost incomprehensible to us today. It was a different era. And I think a lot of the attempts to blame Enlightenment thinkers for slavery and imperialism are bizarre. I think it's part of the current academic mindset to reduce all issues to a question of racism, to see the entire world through the lens of racism and anti-racism. And some of them were racists because in the 18th century, almost everyone was a racist. And unless we write off the past as a bunch of bad people, we've got to appreciate the thinkers in the context of their era. Examine the ideas separately, unbundle them, not say was Hume a good guy or a bad guy, but rather among the things that Hume said, which of them were well defended and still worth defending.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Daniel Ben-Koren and edited by Tom Hall. Join us for part two of Steven Pinker and David Runciman in the following episode. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should be talking about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com or tweet us at intelligence2.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.